Aloha. This is The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, January 17th. I'm Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. It is around this time of year that efforts would be underway to provide a point-in-time count of homelessness. Why the snapshot will be different this year, we hear from Partners in Care. We look at the housing situation on Maui as an eviction moratorium is set to expire next month, what residents can expect going forward. In his final days in office, President Joe Biden acknowledges the contribution of a group of Native Hawaiians who volunteered to live on uninhabited islands in the Pacific. Know the story of Under a Jarvis Moon? And this weekend marks the 125th anniversary of the Chinatown fires here on Oahu. We acknowledge the stories of that time in our Honolulu and hear from a poet inspired by that history. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. The recent headlines that outreach workers would not be out on the streets counting the homeless this month raised some eyebrows, but Partners in Care Director Laura Thielen clarified her group and its partners on the neighbor islands are actually only mandated to do the count every other year. She came to our studio recently to talk about the decision and the coordinated effort required for the point-in-time count.
We start planning for a point-in-time count back in October, September of the previous year. And when we started to plan for it, we reached out to our counterpart on the neighbor islands, which is called Bridging the Gap, and they had already made the decision that they were not going to do the count in 2025. So with that, we went to our regional outreach leads, and those are the people that are on the ground every single day, and it is their choice and the choice of the continuum of care on whether or not to host the count every year. So HUD requires that we conduct a count, both unsheltered and sheltered, at least once every 2 years. The mandatory one has to fall on an even year. So we did the 2024 count, and then our next mandated one is in 2026. We made the decision to hold off on the count this year for several reasons. Number one, Bridging the Gap had already made that decision not to do the count this year. Another reason was HUD has changed their funding cycle to be a 2-year term. And so we're wondering if HUD is also going to look at that as a reason not to mandate the point-in-time count any more than once every 2 years. Some of the other reasons that come to mind is doing the point-in-count takes a lot of resources. It's expensive in regards to the number of people that we have working on it. Last year, we had well over 300, I think almost 400 people volunteering or working as part of their agency work out in the field. And that's just a lot of resources that get taken advantage of. And while data is really, really important, good data is more important. And so what we are looking at now is because we are going to take this break, we're going to be able to do some other studies with our time and our resources. And I think they will be studies and deeper dives into the data that we already have that will really help us figure out not just how many folks are experiencing homelessness, but more importantly, why are people falling back into homelessness after being housed? What are the reasons that people are precariously housed? And figuring out what are the services that are really in our gaps right now? So, you know, are people not successful in housing or in the homeless service providing area? Are they not getting the services that will really help them stay in housing once they go in? So we are partnered with UH, and during the next several months, we'll be putting a lot of effort into figuring out what the data is telling us. You know, we're always asked to be accountable for all the programs and all the funding that we get. This is a way for us to look at every single program and say, okay, we need to tweak a few things here because we can see over the course of the last 7 years, that this gap has not been filled. It also gives us an opportunity to really help the providers who have lots of job openings. They're working with more people, with more services, with less resources.
Well, what department are you working with up at UH? Is it School of Social Work?
We work with Anna Pruitt and Jack Burrill, and they are research personnel, and they also use their grad students. I believe they're technically in the School of Psychology, but they have been working with us for years, and so they have all the data, access to all of the data, so that we can do these bigger, more in-depth data dives. And so we were just talking this morning about what some of these different studies are going to look like and how we can be more accountable to the community and to our funders to say, okay, these programs are really working and these ones are not for this and this reason, and we can help to improve those. We've seen over the last year and a half a huge increase in the number of beds that have been created through the Kauhale initiative that the governor has started. But with those Kauhales, we don't have a lot of information. They're not collecting as much data as we want them to collect. So we're also focusing a lot of our time to making sure that any new resource that comes online, that they are connected into the system so that they can actually provide that continuity of care for those folks out on the streets.
Okay, so you're actually then also maybe redeploying some efforts
for
drilling down to be more effective.
To be more effective, to be more accountable, to be more effective, and actually figure out we're heading into a new administration at HUD. We'll have a new director at HUD as well as at the Interagency Council on Homelessness. So figuring out their priorities and making sure that we're addressing as many folks as we can out on the streets.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't sure if, you know, there had been any incidents out there with our staff, you know, doing the count.
No, nothing has come up. The only thing that even was mildly concerning is there's always dogs out on the streets with folks. So making sure that everybody is really safe with that. But we deployed police officers with all of our groups and had them at the ready, and no incidents have happened. But what we are seeing is, you know, CORE and the mayor's office, they're working really hard on some new initiatives. And so making sure that we're all in line and that we know what each other is doing, so that we don't double our efforts, but actually streamline our efforts together. And I've been lucky enough to be asked to be at the table with the mayor and his leaders in the homeless and housing field. And so it's been really great to be able to share what happens out on the ground and then bring it into a policy type of situation.
And then is there anything more that you were hearing from, let's say, the Big Island? And was it Brandy?
Yep, it was Brandy is the chair of the continuum of care over, and it encompasses all of the neighbor islands, and she's on Hawaii, and she is the executive director of Hope Services. And I think for especially Maui, but even still with Hawaii, they're dealing with the fire effects and still working on those. And then, of course, we're looking at figuring out how many people are coming over to Oahu that were affected by the fires in Lahaina or on the Big Island. We saw a few, probably like 36 at the most, that stated that they had come over to Oahu before last year's count. So they were counted in our count. And so we'll be doing the same, making sure that we are acknowledging if anybody from, say, California comes over after those fires. So those are the kind of things that are based on natural disasters and other things that may affect our system.
Anything else that you're hearing from your counterparts on the neighbor islands? I mean, I don't know if there are particular reasons why the Big Island pulled back.
I don't know all of the reasons of why they decided that, but I know from, I've been an outreach worker for years, and the strain of doing that count is big because it's not just going out on that day and talking to people. It's prepping them so that they're not afraid to talk to us. It's asking them very invasive questions that we really need the answers to. And so getting people to trust us and answer, you know, 5-page survey is really tough. And so I think, you know, the exhaustion that comes with doing an event like a point in time count, we're really ready for it. My agency, we are responsible for putting the data together and for making the surveys available. So we're all set. We could have done it this year from that aspect. But, you know, we really need to listen to the people that are boots on the ground and who are just exhausted. And they need our support in other ways right now.
Okay, so just take a break.
Yep.
And then resume that full count 2026 when it is required.
Yep. And the other thing is that, you know, a lot of people question the point in time count. It is only one piece of data that we look at. And for years, it's always come out, you know, community members are like, you know, there's much more homeless than this. And we admit it, that it's not a perfect count. It never will be. But if we pair that kind of data with like our inflow and outflow data, the inflow and outflow data that we have actually shows exactly how many people get any type of homeless service throughout the year. And so we've got more than 12,000 individuals that have gotten some type of homeless service or housing through the continuum of care over the last year. And that to me is a much more important number because we know there's many more out on the streets that are not getting all those services, but we're touching more than 12,000 people. So that's a huge number difference, but it makes sense because on one day we can only count so many. And we like doing the point in time count because it is a very in-depth survey, but it is just a snapshot in time. And we're looking at the possibility of creating a dashboard or a study that will predict, based on the point in time count, how many other people are experiencing homelessness. So that's another thing that we're looking at for future point in time counts is how can we extrapolate that out and make sure that we're a little bit closer to the true numbers.
That was Laura Thielen with Partners in Care explaining the decision not to be out in the field this month, counting the number of homeless on Oahu and across the islands. The count will take stock of homeless in shelters, and it plans to be back out on the streets next January, which is required by federal law.
Last week on Wait, Wait, actor Josh Gad explained why he felt he could write a memoir at the age of just 43.
And as it started to expand, it just felt like, okay, this may be a story worth telling. And then a publisher paid me, and I was like, okay, it is.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the stories worth making fun of this week with special guest comedian Rose Matafeo. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Beginning Saturday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Nayrit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna with supportive housing, such as the Institute for Human Services, NayritHawaii.com.
An eviction moratorium in place following the Maui wildfires is to expire in a few weeks. Here to talk about what happens next is HPR's Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, this is going to be a tough one, tough time.
It is. So starting on February 4th, the moratorium on Maui evictions due to non-payment specifically is ending. And so this is something that's protected tenants over more than a year since the wildfires. Under the governor's emergency proclamation, it's been extended many times, and now for sure it's ending. And so it's causing a lot of worry, but it doesn't necessarily mean that renters who are behind on rent will automatically get evicted. There's a process in place, and Bavon Bowers is executive director of Maui Mediation Services. She talks about the circumstances surrounding this eviction moratorium.
It was just tremendous frustration and hurt from those cataclysmic events. And the governor wanted to just put a pause to allow tenants and landlords to deal with the crises. But what that led to was landlords, and these are the stories that we heard in our office, some were unable to pay their mortgages. And then a lot of tenants were calling saying, hey, my landlord's trying to put me out. Many weren't aware of the moratorium, and so we became a place of providing legal information. We are one of five community mediation centers across the state. And by contract, we provide mediations for residential landlord-tenant cases in our Second Circuit courthouses. So this is an area where our mediators have a great deal of experience. And so we recognize the frustrations that parties bring when they are just not understanding why they can't pursue an avenue that previously they could.
Yeah, pretty tough time.
Yeah, she said a lot of frustration, you know, and confusion on both sides. So in July, the governor signed Act 202. And Act 202 specifically relates to this transition from the moratorium to where evictions will be possible for non-payment. And it establishes a process that mandates mediation through the Maui Mediation Services before evictions go to court. And so here's Bowers explaining that process.
What we are doing is, as of February 5th, before a landlord can proceed with an eviction for non-payment of rent, they must send a notice to the tenant, either by posting or they're allowed to send it by U.S. mail. And simultaneously, they must send Maui Mediation Services a notice. What that does is trigger a 15-day period where we will be trying to make contact with the tenant to set up a mediation, because the landlord must come to us before he can proceed to the courthouse. So it's empowering both parties, because, Catherine, oftentimes they haven't had a conversation, or something has happened where the tenant has moved, there is loss of contact information, and this moratorium, the process is very date specific. So we've got 15 days to make contact with the tenant and schedule a mediation. The earliest that a landlord can proceed is 30 days, because say we get a hold of that tenant on the 14th day, and the court encouraged communication between the parties. So we then will have an opportunity to mediate and hopefully come to an agreement. And people are like, well, why do I want to sit down with them? Because oftentimes you don't know their full story, nor do they know yours. And it's a way of promoting civility and peace in a time that has been so fraught with frustration.
You know, I know there were programs to help people pay rent. So how did this all play out and work?
So there are rent assistance programs through FEMA. There are some different post-fire assistances available. But one big question here is how many evictions will actually be happening after February 4th? And no one really knows. So I checked with the governor's office. I checked with the Department of Commerce and Consumer Protection. I checked with Maui Mediation Services, wasn't sure, community organizations. And so there's really big question marks here as to what we're going to be seeing here over the next couple of months. Bowers says, you know, she just won't know until landlords start filing these eviction notices. And it's set through the state to be a staggered schedule to prevent an overload of cases coming through the Maui Mediation Center. So starting February 5th through March 6th, tenants who are owing 4 or more months of rent can start to request mediation. Then the following month, March through May, tenants owing 3 months or more of rent can initiate this process. And so on and so forth. It's, you know, set up to try and accommodate and plan ahead for how many cases may be coming through. But, you know, again, that number just is a big unknown at this point. I spoke with Nara Boone, who's co-founder of the Maui Housing Hui. They do affordable housing advocacy, renters' rights, and she shared just how dire the housing climate on Maui continues to be and how the moratorium ending is affecting people.
You know, I think a lot of people are a little bit in shock. And I think there's a lot of throwing the hands up in the air, like, what else can I do? What we don't have in place are safe spaces for people to park their cars and get a good night's sleep. People are saying, well, what do we do? What do we do? What are our options? And mediation is the option. And whether that results in some kind of agreement of other types of repayments or something else, I'm not sure exactly, you know, what the outcomes will be with that. It's just a very difficult situation. And then we have landlords that need to pay their mortgages and are worried about, you know, their own financial status. For me, rental assistance would be the way to go because that helps the landlords as much as it helps the tenants.
Yeah, those landlords are in a tough spot because, yeah, that money's due.
Absolutely. And part of, you know, something important to acknowledge here is this isn't just for fire survivors. So, you know, as you had asked earlier, there are assistance programs in place for fire survivors. But, you know, as we know, this has boiled over into many folks who weren't directly affected by the fire, as in lost their homes or, you know, lost their jobs. These are folks on Maui who have been just really tough circumstances, super tight on housing, having a hard time finding housing at all. Many and much of the housing that's available, you know, is just over their budget. And so, you know, as Boone mentioned, that rental assistance for people who may be falling through those gaps and not receiving rental assistance as a fire survivor just isn't available for a lot of folks. And so one protection that is still in place is tenants are still protected from rent increases. So that is, as of now, something that will remain in place through the emergency proclamation. And so that's a plus. And the message to tenants here really that Bowers and Boone brought up is just to really be proactive. If you know that you're behind on rent, you know, don't wait to contact Maui Mediation Services. They can get that process started before February 5th. And Boone also tells people, if you get an eviction notice from your landlord, don't panic and pack up. You know, it's not an immediate process. You know, it still has to go through the court. There's still a time frame set by Act 202. So it's not an instantaneous thing.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Look for her coverage on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. A large crowd is gathering at Iolani Palace as we speak, taking part in an annual march that kicked off this morning at Mauna Ala Royal Mausoleum. The march went down Nu'uanu Avenue before ending at the palace. Participants are marking the 132nd year since the illegal overthrow of Queen Liliuokalani and the establishment of a provisional government under Sanford B. Dole. You can bring your own chair and water to take in all the speeches and free entertainment scheduled until 5 p.m. Speakers include Ernie Lau from the Board of Water Supply and activists from Lahaina Strong. For today's quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us the Hawaiian name given to the march and what it means. If you need a hint, we'll tell you that the name comes from a quote from Queen Liliuokalani. It reads, "Hold fast to the pride and love you have for your country." Yes, your country, for your nation, blank. What comes next? Give us a ring at 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're the first to answer correctly, you'll win a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NareitHawaii.com.
What One of the last official actions President Joe Biden took before he leaves office this week was to acknowledge participation of a group of 135 Native Hawaiian young men who helped to secure remote Pacific Islands under the jurisdiction of the U.S. during the 1930s. It was a story that was captured in a 2010 documentary entitled Under a Jarvis Moon. Take a listen to a clip.
When we had a full moon, it was a time when you more or less felt homesick for being, because we were away from home and we thought about our family, friends, girlfriend. And Frederick Lee, my partner, said, George, we should compose a song about Jarvis. And I said, okay, that sounds like a good idea. And so he brought out his guitar and he started to play.
I first really heard about the colonization project when an archivist at Bishop Museum asked me if I was related to a George Kahanu. And George is my grandfather. And she said that the museum had a logbook that belonged to him from when he was living on Jarvis Island in the 1930s. So I went up to the archives and she pulled out this old logbook and I opened it up, and there was the handwriting of my grandfather when he was 17, 18 years old. And these were things that he wrote as a young man when he was living on this desert island 1,500 miles from home.
Department of Commerce, presiding over aviation affairs, sits Able Director Eugene Vidal. Of an assistant, William T. Miller, Director Vidal makes a curious request.
You think you can dig up 12 young men who are willing to go out 3,000 miles in the Pacific and live on a desert island, maybe for months?
There, Mr. Miller calls on the principal of a school where boys of Royal Hawaiian blood are educated. From among these young American citizens, U.S. Agent Miller enlists volunteers for a secret adventure. Waiting in Honolulu's Pearl Harbor is a Coast Guard cutter under sealed orders to take the 12 young volunteers to their unknown destination.
The whole story started for Kamehameha Schools with the arrival of a complement of people from Washington, D.C., who were here to find out how to go about colonizing three tiny little islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
And that was part of a clip from the film Under a Jarvis Moon. It was co-produced by Heather Juni and Noel Kahanu. They joined us in studio this morning. Kahanu just returned from Washington, D.C. after taking part in a ceremony at the White House on Tuesday. It was part of the president's message reflecting on his accomplishments during his term in office, and it included official acknowledgement of the story of Hui Panala'au, which is essentially translates to holders of the land. Kahanu starts us off.
So the Hui Panala'au were 135, mostly Native Hawaiian young men who occupied the islands of Howland, Baker, Jarvis, Canton, and Enderbury from 1935 to 1942. It ended in the opening days of America's entry into World War II. The islands were bombed, actually, a day after Pearl Harbor on December 8th. Two boys, two Native Hawaiian colonists, Dickie Whaley and Joe Kili'i Hananui, died in that attack. There was one other, Carl Kahalevai, who died from a ruptured appendix in 1939. So the presidential message recognized the ultimate sacrifice that these three
young Hawaiians had made on behalf of our country.
And this story has just been overlooked. And I learned about it, you know, through the documentary Under a Jarvis Moon. And Heather, maybe you should jump in here because, you know, talk about getting that story broadcast out to the wider community.
Well, actually, I think, and Noelle, correct me if I'm wrong, but I first heard the story at a Hawaiian Civics Convention in Las Vegas. And I walked into this large, packed room with this elderly man, Kupuna, on that far end, telling this riveting story. And as I looked at the crowd, I saw Noelle, who I had known and connected that was her grandfather. And I went up to her and I told her what a great documentary this would make. And she, you know, she was really busy doing exhibits for this and really pushing the story and trying to get the story out there. And she had this idea at some point that she wanted to do a documentary and invited me along. And basically because she had never done a documentary before. And so she needed, you know, tips on how to do it. And we did that. And it was really, really an incredible journey. And I'm really grateful for her for giving me the opportunity to be on it with her.
And then, yeah, I mean, my connection with you is, you know, through television news, right? And so when you see these stories out there and the fact that you have a personal connection, Noelle, because of your family, I mean, that was your passion.
Yeah. So my grandfather, George Kahanu Sr., was one of the colonists. He was 17, actually, when he first went. So it blows my mind. But many of these, in the early years, they were actually Kamehameha School students. And we would never do this now. Obviously, you would get parental consent. You would have, you know, signing waivers. But in those days, Kamehameha Schools was a boarding school. And families entrusted the care of their sons and daughters to Kamehameha Schools. And so they didn't ask for parental consent. And so some of these boys spent, you know, their summers. So for Grandpa, it was one summer as a spare. And then part of his school year, he was also up there on Jarvis Island. One of the first colonists was actually A.P. Anaya, and he was a graduate. So the first group, they were graduates. But after that, many of them were students. And then as the years progressed, they ended up moving outside of Kamehameha schools, and they were recruiting from McKinley, Roosevelt, other places, Farrington.
Well, I mean, that's such a fascinating history, and it's not well known because these islands are very remote, and then there was a lot going on, you know, with the bombing and with the war. But the fact that we had this acknowledgement, you know, what does that mean? And as far as access that the public at large has to not only the history and maybe all the names of, what is it, the 130?
There are 135. So I was reflecting on the time, you know, like Heather mentioned when she first heard Grandpapa speaking, you know, the exhibition that opened at Bishop Museum was in 2002. So we're talking over 20 years ago now at this point, right? The documentary itself probably came out around 2010. Mm-hmm. And again, we're talking 15 years now after that point. And this realization that not only was it a lost story that was, you know, being refound, but understanding the pivotal role that these men collectively played in the U.S. securing these islands, and then today maintaining control. So Jarvis, Baker, and Howland are still U.S. possessions. They're national wildlife refuges. So, you know, this notion that they were deserving of recognition. There was a Senate resolution that was passed in 2015, U.S. Senate, to recognize them. But this is the first official administrative action by any president to recognize them. It's a message. It's called a presidential message. But if you go to that presidential message, there's actually a link to a fact sheet. And that fact sheet tells a more fuller story, including listing every single one of the names of the 135, which they verified through the employment records of the Department of Interior and Air Commerce. They also, unbeknownst to me, scanned 15 boxes of archival material at the National Archives, and that's now available. So the resources for families who want to find out more about their loved ones who participated, not only is through that source, but also separately, we had an Institute of Museum Library Services grant, Pacific American Foundation. We worked with them, and it's now online, huipanalaau.org. You can type in a name, and it pulls up documents from multiple repositories, including Ulu'ulu that Heather mentioned earlier, Kamehameha Schools, University of Hawaii, Bishop Museum, State Archives, National Archives.
I don't know, I'm getting like chicken skin, you know. And Heather, you know, your dad has a history there in Congress, you know, Henry and Senator Dan Inouye. And so the significance of this is acknowledgement of, you know, the Pacific Islanders' role in all of this. And what does that mean to you?
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm so proud of what Noelle has done. So I feel like she's done it single-handedly these past 25 years. Obviously, impassioned because it's her grandfather, but also for the love of community and for all of these young boys that participated, and it's for their families and for the generations in the future. And what I noted just recently, and as I saw a picture of Noelle with President Biden holding hands like they were besties in this picture, it was really very cute. I reflected on the connection that they had with Senator Inouye. So I think few people know that when President Biden was a senator and he first arrived in Washington, D.C., his office was right across from room 442, which was the office of Senator Inouye. And this was back in 1972, 73, and they became very close and had a very long-lasting relationship. And through that relationship, President Biden became familiar with Native Hawaiians, the Pacific community, as well as Native Americans. He served on the Senate Select Committee on Indian Affairs. Inouye was chair. Noelle worked there as an employee.
Wow.
So a long time ago.
Yes, but still, the building of knowledge, a knowledge well that Senator brought to people in Congress. I believe that, you know, that was part of the interest of the president to make this happen. The White House wanted to make sure that this happened before he departed.
Yeah, and we all know that it's people behind the people. And I do really want to recognize Erica Moritsugu, who was the liaison for Asian, Native American, and Pacific Island issues for the president. And she worked really hard to make this happen. And you know, one of the things, I'll just share this personally, was that my father, my grandfather's firstborn son, had just passed a few days before I went to Washington, D.C. And, you know, under normal circumstances, I wouldn't have gone. But because it was so much about my grandfather's legacy and by extension, our family and my father. And so I decided to go. And Erica said, call me when you arrive. And they were waiting, this little group by the coat rack for me. And I just started crying. And then I come to find out, like, there was nobody else from Hawaii. It was a really small event, relatively small event. And, like, I was the only one from home. And I didn't realize, yeah, how small the event was and how much, like, it meant to them, too, to be able to work towards something that they had spent a lot of time, years on, really, trying to ensure that there was some sort of recognition, presidential recognition that happened from President Biden. And so I'm very grateful to her in particular for facilitating this process and making me feel welcome and insisting, she said, that it was something President Biden really personally cared about.
Yeah. And so I'm sure your dad and Heather, your dad, you know, Henry, he was Sergeant of Arms, you know, there in the Senate. And oh, my gosh, they just must be smiling this week.
Yeah, I'm sure. But the kick too, you know, it's a small community, is even smaller back in those days, that her grandfather and my grandfather worked together at Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
So, and I found that out through meeting him and him saying it's pretty much that. It was really, and the families, they get to know this story that they never heard. And they get to see their grandfathers or their fathers in a different light. It's been really remarkable to watch.
Well, I thank both of you for coming down here and sharing this story and preserving it for all of us.
It was a little bittersweet, I'll just say this, because they're all long gone. You know, my grandfather passed in 2015, and we're talking 10 years later. There's some measure of administrative recognition. But I'm realizing, you know, he may be gone, but we're not. And so the extent that all of these families and their legacies are tied up with this, and that every action of recognition continues to be important and adds to this story. So I was mentioning the website earlier, huiponalaao.org, and so now they have the presidential message posted on that. So it's a growing story that we continue to add to ensure that they're never forgotten.
That was Noel Kahanu and Heather Juni, who joined us this morning in studio to talk about the White House's acknowledgement of a little-known story about a group of young Hawaiian men who went to live and work on several remote islands in the Pacific. The group is known as the Hui Apanala'au. Look for links on our website later today. And now it's time for the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about a memorial march that first took place on January 17, 1993. It was organized to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the overthrow of Queen Liliuokalani and the establishment of a provisional government. The inaugural march began at Aloha Tower and ended with a gathering at Iolani Palace. About 15,000 people participated in the march after several days of chanting, somber musical performances, and passionate speeches. For today's quiz, we asked you if you could tell us the name given to the march and the events that preceded it. And the answer comes from a quote from Queen Liliuokalani: "Hold fast to the pride and love that you have for your country. Yes, your country for your nation. Onipa'a. Hold fast." Onipa'a can mean steadfast, firm, resolute, or determined. And our winner today, Julia Rodby from Nu'u'anu, knew the answer because she said it reminded her of a pihi, which is strongly steadfast on the rocks of our shore. That's our quiz today. If you have one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
When you support HPR, you help shine the spotlight on Hawaii's next generation of musicians.
How long have you been playing the violin?
I've been playing for about 7 years. I got my violin for Christmas when I was 6, and then I started playing probably a month after.
Hear from local students every Tuesday on HPR2's Classical Pacific.
I'd say just number one thing for really any musician, but even percussionists too, it's really just all about persistence and exactness. There will be times where, you know, you kind of get down about it, but there's always a light around the corner.
Help HPR uplift Hawaii's youngest musicians. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
On Monday, many will be observing the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, but January 20th also marks the 125th anniversary of the Chinatown fires here on Oahu. The blaze was set in response to the outbreak of the bubonic plague, and it started with the burning of one building a day, but the fire burned out of control and wiped out 16 blocks. That time in history is acknowledged in a collection of poems by a Wing Tech Lum. He joined us in our studio recently to talk about a new book entitled The Old Time. It's his third collection of poems, and a section is dedicated to life imagined during the Great Fire. His grandfather owned a store there that burned.
The fire. The health board condemns the shanties as someone inside has died from the plague. Other inhabitants are summarily evicted, gathering whatever they can, but with nowhere to go. The fire department surrounds the perimeter, poised with their hoses for the start of the burn. A crowd converges, curious, angry, and resigned, and worried that they themselves will be next. The fire is ignited as rehearsed, but unexpected gusts come down from the valley. Firemen vainly try to contain its spread. People are stunned, immobile, uncertain about what to do. Before long, embers billow up, wafted by the wind, and jump from rooftop to rooftop. Residents rush to stamp out spot fires, tearing down even their own houses to form fire breaks. Narrow alleyways turn into gauntlets of flame. A fire scours the street, combusting all in its path. Faces are blistered, hair singed, eyes wide from fear. Everyone is shouting, drowning out the chaos. A store selling fireworks for the new year explodes. A lumberyard blazes. A few run home to retrieve gold or papers. Most, though, just flee with the clothes on their backs. Inexorably, the inferno marches toward the wharves. It melts electric coils and a hastily abandoned fire engine. Volunteers carry on their backs women with bound feet. Opium addicts delirious are rescued from their den. The refugees try to escape the conflagration, wanting to cross the bridge over the stream. But quarantine militia, pick handles ready, block their way, leaving them to huddle in a no man's land to wait. Sparks fly into the steeple of the church. Soon it becomes a furnace, consuming its beams. Unsupported, its bells crash into the sanctuary below. All of Chinatown hears this dirge.
And the church?
Kamakapili, the first location for Kamakapili on Smith and Baratania. And that's why they had to move to Palama, where they are now.
The current site, yes, yes.
That was the time of my grandfather and his generation, pioneers who had come in around the 1880s, 1890s to Hawaii, and many of them did settle in Chinatown. This was even before the 1900 fire. And so I wanted to write about his pioneer generation. So I was fixated on that particular time and that particular place in Chinatown, but also Chinese who lived in the rural areas as well.
And, you know, as I was looking at some of the photos of the Chinatown fire and the plague, they're just stunning, really.
Yes.
You know, what the people went through.
The context of the poem that I just read really is something like they discovered in December of 1899, December 12th, one person in Chinatown died, and they discovered it was bubonic plague that had come from China. And so then more deaths followed, and they eventually decided, the Board of Health, to have a quarantine, a lockdown, but only of the Chinatown area. And so this started just before the new year, 1900. And they did that and had militia patrolling the streets around Chinatown. It was about 16 blocks. After that, what happened was if there were more people who died, wherever somebody had died, basically they decided to burn that particular structure and evict everybody else and put them in detention camps. And so from around New Year's to January 20th, about 3 weeks, they burnt down at least one building per day because there were more deaths. And unfortunately, on January 20th, the fire got out of control and burnt down all of Chinatown, 38 acres, nearly all of the 16 blocks of Chinatown. There's some remnants, but primarily all of Chinatown was burnt down. So what was cordoned off in a lockdown period for about 3 or 4 weeks, it just disappeared. That was a really unfortunate, traumatic experience for the 7,000 people that were living in the area. You can see some photos just after the fire where there's remnants of the church still standing. There are a few trees that were still standing, but everything else is just vacant land. It's like a volcano crater. There's just nothing there. And so people had to start from scratch and rebuild. So if you go to Chinatown now and you look and see some of the buildings, you can see that they have the date of when the building was erected. Some of them are 1901, 1902, but nothing is before 1900.
And so what is your present-day connection to Chinatown?
Well, my grandfather had a store in Chinatown. It burnt down like everybody else's. He eventually rebuilt that particular building, had a store again, and we've been in Chinatown for the next generation. So I'm a third generation member of our family who has been in Chinatown for all this time.
And so do you have a store down there?
We have an office there. So yes, we're in real estate right now.
And so I guess when you think of Chinatown today and this time in history, you put together this book of poetry, and it's called The Old Timers. But this is your third book.
Yes.
And so what makes this, say, different from your first two?
Well, the other two, I was exploring other topics. The first one was about my family and being a Chinese American. And the second one was specifically about the Nanjing Massacre in China. So this particular book was about 8 years worth of work, just researching and then writing poems. There's about 82 poems in the book trying to describe what happened during that period of time, circa 1900, in the Chinese community in Hawaii. So I do describe some things like what they did as far as employment, all the jobs that they took. I talk about their relationships with other people like Native Hawaiians, and I also try to describe what they did to organize themselves so that they could have a community primarily of bachelors, because they were not able to bring their women to Hawaii. So primarily a society of bachelors who had to form a new kind of a society that is different from what they had in the villages back home.
And then what can you say about the current day Chinese societies that still, you know, exist in Chinatown?
Well, it's completely different. The people who are still in Chinatown, or the Chinese community in general in Hawaii, are the descendants of those who were able to procreate. There are a lot of the pioneer generation that were not able to marry, were not able to bring their wives, and so they basically died off. They did not have any progeny. There are others who intermarried, married Native Hawaiian women,
had
especially.
Families.
Yes, and had families. So there's a large population of part Hawaiian, part Chinese, and there are also Chinese who were primarily of a merchant or a successful entrepreneur class, and they had progeny who are the main descendants of the Chinese community here at present.
That was poet Wing Tek Lum talking about the 125th anniversary of the Chinatown fires in Hawaii. Lum says the first poem in the section of his book about the fires mentions rodents, and ironically, after the fire was Chinese New Year, which happened to celebrate the Year of the Rat. Lum will take part in a reading of his poems on Sunday in Chinatown. It will be held at the Native Books at Arts and Letters at 1164 Nu'uanu Avenue from 3 to 5 p.m. Well, that is it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we will be observing the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, but we'll be back on Tuesday for the State of the State Address speech by Governor Josh Green. We do welcome feedback. Call 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, with help from Savannah Harriman-Pote, Tori DeJournay, and Mark Liddell. Our backyard quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music, thanks to Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us Monday. Pick up The Conversation.